on ABC Radio Queensland, you're with Henry Brett.
13 minutes past 10, and I'm sure a lot of you recognise this. Yes. Harry Potter. That's the tune from the series, but did you know that the Philosopher's Stone is a real thing? A real thing. It's a real stone, and there's a lot of myths around it. Some have been made famous by this book and film series, and of course, that pesky Lord Voldemort always was trying to get his hands on it, wasn't he?
Together, we'll do extraordinary things. Just give me the stone!
I don't know where you stand on Voldemort. I don't like the guy. I don't reckon he's a good bloke. You might feel differently, but I don't love his vibe. But anyway, Richard Bean is a research fellow of data science at the University of Queensland, and he played a vital role in cracking the code to the recipe of the real Philosopher's Stone. Richard, welcome to Mornings.
Hey, Henry.
Thank you for coming on. So this is called the Elixir of Life, and there's been so many myths about it over centuries. But what actually is the Philosopher's Stone?
Well, it's a concept, really, that it's a drink or a stone that you create in an alchemical process, like a furnace, a slow cooker, I suppose, that when you get to the final stage, you take it out of the furnace, you'll have a drink which will cure all illnesses, lead you to eternal life, and it will also help you turn base metals like lead into gold.
And what is alchemy when we talk about that study?
Well, the main quest of medieval alchemy, that's the predecessor to modern chemistry, was trying out all kinds of experiments so that they could achieve this philosopher's stone. So lots of people have wrote out recipes claiming that they'd created the philosopher's stone, and the author of this encrypted text we're going to talk about, that's Arthur Dee, an English alchemist who was a physician to the Tsar of Russia. In 1634, he claimed he'd found the recipe for the actual philosopher's stone. So it's probably related to this text.
So you've deciphered this manuscript that's 400 years old. What was involved in that process?
Well, it starts right at the beginning in the British Library. My co-authors, Megan from the Science History Institute in the US and Sarah from the University of Graz in Austria, they found this manuscript in the British Library, and they presented their results in a historical cryptology conference. They said, look, you know, here's this encrypted pages from a manuscript, and we tried some things, but we haven't been able to crack it yet. So this was in August this year. And so the first thing I did was try to work out what language it was in. So that's turned out to be in Latin, because Arthur Dee and his famous father, John Dee, just wrote in English and Latin. And then it was a matter of using my statistical tables and algorithms from my previous successful cracking projects to get cracking on the on the project.
So you said it was from August, it was still uncracked, and so it sounds like it was a pretty big effort. Were there times where you just thought, I'm not going to get this thing, getting really frustrated?
Oh yeah, because it uses a cipher that was invented in the 1500s by an Italian cryptologist, Giovan Battista Balasso, and it's quite a difficult cipher. But the problem is, like, you don't know exactly how it was used, and it ended up like having some mistakes in the encipherment in the text. It used a slightly different table, but most of all, the key was 45 letters long. So Even if Megan and Sarah had like access to automated Porter cipher solving software, it probably wouldn't have considered a key phrase that long, because that's way longer than you'd use for any computer password these days. It's quite extraordinary.
Richard Bean from the University of Queensland. This isn't the first code that you've cracked. How did this one compare with other codes you've broken before?
Well, it all comes down to, do you know exactly how the cipher was created? So what method was used? So there was a 1920s IRA cipher I cracked. I knew that was transposition. There was a 1940s life after death cipher. I knew that was a so-called book cipher. There was a 1960s cipher from the Biafran War. I knew that was transposition. I've been working on the encrypted sculpture at the CIA, Cryptos from 1990, and nobody knows what algorithm has been used. So here I knew approximately what algorithm was used, but I had to zoom in on exactly, you know, how the table and the key were used to be able to crack it. So it took a few weekends. So I'd say it was harder than some of the transposition ciphers in a way, but it's not as hard as a code like Cryptos, where you have no idea what algorithm is in use.
A few weekends, I think. if you could comprehend how little I achieve on a weekend, a few weekends is a pretty impressive effort. It seems, Richard, that in fantasy novels and looking back through history, we hear so much about codes, but do people still use codes? Are they a bit out of fashion?
Oh, yeah. Well, to link it back to this, Megan and Sarah presented this manuscript in a hall opened by Dan Brown. And Dan Brown just puts, you know, hit novel out after hit novel out,
yeah,
using all these codes and anagrams and Opus Dei and the Masons. And he just makes bestseller after bestseller. People love reading about this. But, of course, in the modern world, yeah, codes are used seriously in electronic commerce, cybersecurity. There's more technically, there's public key and private key encryption. There's a lot to learn, and it encompasses mathematics and computer science. It's very interdisciplinary. So if you are a listener and you are studying this kind of school, you know, at school, this kind of thing, then, you know, you'll have to work hard if you want to get into this area.
And now that you have the recipe, you've uncracked it, you've got the recipe for the stone that is supposed to offer eternal life, will you be trying to make it?
It's a bit ambiguous. I think I'll need my co-author's support to work out, like, the context and what the ingredients are.
Yeah, okay. So, it's not just a bit of paprika and water. I imagine it's a pretty complicated one.
There's mercury and euphemisms like ravens and swans. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. You might have to pluck the feather of a raven when clock strike 12. not your usual recipe. Has anyone tried to make this in the past?
Yeah. There's a book called The Experimental Fire by Jennifer Rampling. And in the middle of the book, she tries to create some of these recipes, and obviously she doesn't achieve the eternal life or turning things into gold. That would take a particle accelerator, but it is sort of trying to see if she can get some of the color transmutations going, like turning some metals into red metals or a red sheen, golden sheen, that sort of thing. It certainly happens. It's called chemistry. So you replace the E in chemistry with a Y.
Chemistry. There you go. Now, yeah. Are you a Harry Potter fan, Richard?
I've seen one of the movies, and I was certainly Voldemort's voice gave me some real Darth Vader vibes there. I think I'd like to spend time in a room with him.
Nah, I don't like him.
Yeah, that's certainly the same thing. The Philosopher's Stone. It was a real concept. Isaac Newton worked on it.
Well, you better be careful, because if you've discovered anything close to the Philosopher's Stone, I know Voldemort did go all out to get his hands on it, so maybe make sure the door's locked at night. Richard Bean is a Research Fellow of Data Science at the University of Queensland. Thank you very much for taking us to the world of alchemy and this incredible research you have done. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Henry.